KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Rafael, California.
I'm from San Jose,
Hayward, California.
NOPA.
Kind of lower Russian Hill.
I live across from El Metate in San Francisco.
Coming up, a story about a bird that lives in the Bay and eats our trash.
If possible, you know, and this will definitely play well in the Bay Area, it's just a sort of just blame it on LA. It's all their fault.
Then in Bay Area Beats, we'll hear the story of the San Francisco band Dequila, who after more than four decades are reaching a new generation of fans.
So I'm having a good time recreating and sharing the music now because I think it's better. It's funkier. It's deeper.
Getting sweeter with time. Stay tuned. Cross Currents is coming up. You know those Rube Goldberg machines where you hit one thing and then it hits something else and that hits something else, setting off a chain reaction? Well, that's what our first story is about. KALW science reporter Marissa Ortega Welch brings us a tale about a bird that started nesting in the Bay Area and is now eating threatened bird species. And it might all be because of a chain reaction that we humans started.
Okay, we need to get this out of the way first. We're talking about gulls like seagulls.
Or bagel, right? With cream cheese.
This is Christy Nelson, biologist with the science organization Point Blue.
I mean, if you want to get all snooty about it, yeah, there's no such thing as a seagull.
There are lots of different kinds of gulls. Western gulls are the ones famous for showing up at AT&T Park. Nelson studies a species called the California gull. I'm going with Nelson on one of her surveys. We're at Mono Lake, just east of Yosemite, about 160 miles from the Bay Area as the gull flies. It's this giant salty lake in the eastern Sierra, sort of like California's inland ocean. The gulls nest here in the spring, and then most fly out to the California coast in the winter to feed.
These California gulls are traversing, you know, from the ocean to here at Mono Lake, you know, on an annual basis, flying there and back.
We're boating out to some tiny rocky islands.
I'm deciding where to park that has the fewest chicks.
If you didn't like Hitchcock's The Birds, you would not like this scene. There are gulls everywhere, on the ground, hovering directly above us, soaring overhead. We climb out of the boat and carefully walk uphill to Nelson's sample plot. Nelson and her field assistant use thumb clickers to quickly count the number of young birds they see within a fenced-in area.
I've gotten 17, okay. Well, I think we can move on. Leave the birds alone.
All right, let's go. Come on.
We motor over to the next island. Gulls fly above us in every direction.
How many gulls do you estimate we're seeing? It's actually looking like this could be an all-time low. So it seems like a lot. It seems really noisy, but it's actually really a fraction of normal, or at least what used to be normal.
Normal was that 20 years ago, almost all of the state's California gull species nested here at Mono Lake. But something happened to change all that. Even if you've never been to the Eastern Sierra, you may have heard of Mono Lake because it's one of the sources of Los Angeles's water. By the 60s, so much water had been diverted south, the lake was drying up. Environmentalists organized a campaign. You might remember seeing those Save Mono Lake bumper stickers. The lake level got so low in the 70s that the big island where the gulls used to nest,
coyotes were able to essentially walk out there at the lake's low points
and eat all of the gull chicks. The next year, the gulls picked up and moved to these smaller islands we're visiting today. That's incredible because these birds usually nest in the exact same spot every year.
And it was around that same time that a handful of gulls also showed up in a new place, but a really new place, which was the San Francisco Bay.
Let's fly to the bay now. I'm with Max Tarjan, a biologist for the San Francisco Bay Bird Observatory. We're walking on the shoreline in Palo Alto. On one side of us is the bay, and on the other side of us is a marsh with an island.
Yeah, so you can see already just how many gulls are there. Do you see how thick that carpet of white is?
That carpet of white is all the adult gulls, more than 18,000 of them. And then in between, blending in, are the gray young chicks.
So this is the largest breeding colony of California gulls in the South Bay right now.
In 1980, a year after the Great Gull Massacre at Mono Lake, about 20 California gulls started nesting in the South Bay. Before then, the species had never nested on the coast. Scientists don't know for sure that the birds were from Mono Lake, but the timing sure checks out. Since then, Tarjan says,
the breeding population grew and grew and grew,
hitting a peak in 2013 with over 50,000 gulls. The gulls seem to like the South Bay's salt ponds in particular. It's similar habitat to Mono Lake. They both have salty water, they both have islands, and in the South Bay, levees for them to nest on. They both have brine flies and shrimp for them to eat. But the thing about gulls that you probably already know is
they'll eat really anything that they can swallow.
And there's one thing the Bay Area has a lot of that Mono Lake doesn't. Garbage.
They find it like a smorgasbord.
Mark Bowers manages the solid waste program for the city of Sunnyvale. He's giving me a tour of one of the South Bay's waste transfer stations and its gulls.
And what do we got up there? Maybe 20 sitting on the edge of the roof.
The gulls hang out outside the building where trash and recycling are sorted and loaded into trucks. He says it's not nearly what it used to be. 30 years ago,
there were 1,200 gulls flying around, you know, pooping on everything, and we were finding chicken bones up on top of the lamppost covers and, you know, stuff like that. They get the garbage and spread it around and spread diseases and so forth and generally make a nuisance of themselves.
Scientists put radio collars on California gulls to track their movement and discovered that almost all the gulls were getting food from landfills at some point. Waste managers like Bowers have to use all sorts of tricks to try and scare the gulls away. Some bring in falcons. At one point, Bowers used fireworks.
And it's effective, but it's constant. You have to constantly do it. I paid a guy full time to drive around all day and just, you know, harass the gulls.
His boss even ordered him to look into the rumor that lion urine keeps away gulls. But zookeepers told him that was ridiculous.
And I was breathing a sigh of relief, like how am I going to put a requisition through purchasing, you know, one 55-gallon drum of lion urine, please? You know?
Bowers now uses a simple but effective method. He strings wires from poles to the roof of the building. The gulls don't like having to fly around the wires. Studies show that some gulls get up to 80% of their diet from our food trash. That can drive up their population. It's maybe why California gulls are doing so well here. It's easy to blame the birds, but
throwing the food scraps in with their other garbage is what causes this problem.
So the gulls came to the Bay Area to find a safe place to nest and found a great food source in our trash. And then when they're not eating our trash, they turn to something else.
Yeah, so we'll be driving along around this levee, and we'll be surveying here in this pond.
For the next step in this chain reaction, I'm on a ride with biologist Ben Pearl of San Francisco Bay Bird Observatory. We're driving on a levee between two former salt ponds near Hayward. Pearl surveys for snowy plovers, a gray and white shorebird the size of a soda can. It's federally threatened.
So I think people in a lot of parts of coastal California will know snowy plovers as the bird that shuts down the beaches.
The bird likes to nest on open flat areas, but as humans took over the beaches, some plovers moved to these old salt ponds. Some of the ponds have been drained of water, and now they're just these dirt fields. The plovers nest right out in the open, relying on their small size and camouflage to stay hidden.
Probably about 40 snowy plovers foraging here. And right on cue, I see a California gull out there.
The problem is, California gulls like this habitat too, and they will absolutely eat a snowy plover given the chance. They're eating other bayland bird chicks too. Remember, California gulls haven't nested in the Bay Area that long. They're basically the new predator in town, and the birds here didn't evolve with them and learn survival strategies.
We'll see kind of large flocks of gulls sometimes foraging right near where plovers are nesting.
So there's been this interesting cascade of events, right? LA diverted water from Mono Lake, lowered the lake level so coyotes could walk out and eat the gulls, which might have made the gulls start nesting in the bay, and they stayed here because of our food trash, and now they're eating threatened shorebirds?
you know, if possible, you know, and this will definitely play well in the Bay Area. It's just a sort of just blame it on LA. It's all their fault.
Let's fly back to Mono Lake one more time. Biologist Christy Nelson has one more gull survey to do. We boat over to our last island and clamber up on the rocky outcropping. Birds fly overhead, but
I think there's nothing in this pond.
Nothing but weeds.
No adults. Oh, there's one chick. Look, we almost missed one.
Again, it sounds noisy, but compared to what it used to be, the gull population at Mono Lake is shrinking, maybe because of an invasive weed that's taking over where the gulls nest.
But in San Francisco Bay, there's dumps, and there's the nests of bayland nesting shorebirds, and there's probably a lot of food resources for them. So they've taken advantage of a situation that was presented to them.
They've gone from being a species that never nested on the coast to one that's thriving in the Bay Area. The problem is they're sharing space with birds that aren't as adaptable, like the snowy plover. That's the thing about when we humans change the environment. It can set off a chain reaction across species and hundreds of miles. In Mono Lake, I'm Marissa Ortega Welch for Cross Currents.
Marissa is KELW's science reporter. You can find more of her stories at KELW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. In the late 60s and early 70s, a new sound started to emerge from the streets of San Francisco's Mission District. It would come to be known as Latin rock. One of the bands in that scene, Tequila, started out playing Santana covers and went on to become one of the first Filipino-American groups to land a major record deal. Their 1972 self-titled debut album would be the band's only release, but in the years since, they've developed a cult following. After 40 years, original member David Bustamante reformed the band, and he stopped by KALW Studios to tell the story of Tequila for this edition of Bay Area Beats.
My name is David Bustamante, and I am the leader of the legendary band Tequila. I was born in Fort Worth, Texas, with a musical family. My father was a musician in the Air Force and conducting big bands and things like that, and that's how we got our influence in music, all the whole family. And we moved to California when I was, I think, two. We were in Vallejo, actually, you know, so which was sort of an easy place to settle at that time. And this was, I'm talking about 1953. And a lot of Filipino families settled in the Bay Area because of Mare Island, the naval stations of Hamilton Air Force Base, Travis Air Force Base. So from Vallejo, my primary years up until seventh, eighth grade, we moved to San Francisco, and then I finished my high school years in San Francisco, in fact, Balboa High School.
When time comes, you're all alone. Times are on your own. It's your future or your past.
The music in San Francisco was real hot. The recording companies were looking for bands that were similar to Santana, who at that time was still evolving. And we all had our own idea of what music should be coming out of the Mission District, that type of thing, because it was a melting pot of Latinos, Filipinos, a lot of soul music, a lot of Latin groove music. And so it evolved into what, I guess, what they call Latin rock at the time. There was a lot of activity in the parks with percussions and things like that. So a lot of stuff from New York coming over to San Francisco. A lot of
a political activity going on with Cesar Chavez and all these things that were going on in the universities. It was a perfect time to express yourself. My older brother Romeo, who was already actively playing in the San Francisco scene at that time, who also had a Latin rock band, and he was doing Santana covers. And he's the guy that I kind of followed, you know, to be in his band at that time. And while he was doing that, I was still in Vallejo learning my guitar craft and playing with several bands in Vallejo area, including a band that was at that time called Project Soul, who turned into Confunction. So there was a lot of music coming from Vallejo. So when I moved to San Francisco, I was pretty much, I would say, primed and, you know, had some experience already. When I joined the band had to create its own identity to compete with what was going on at the time. And we changed the name to Daquila. It means nobility. It means greatness. The idea came from our dad, you know, because we wanted to be a little different from Santana, a little bit different from Malo, a little different from Azteca, Sapo, who was whatever the local mission bands at that time. Being that we were Filipinos and we had something to say about, you know, our culture. And so it was important that we change our name to that name because it had a Filipino identity to it. After the success of Santana, all these record labels were coming out into San Francisco looking for bands that sort of had that kind of groove or that kind of sound. We got a call from Clive Davis from Columbia, and he saw the band practice, and then he signed us up to Epic Columbia. I says, cool, Columbia. Hey, that's the same label as Santana, Columbia Records. They were really happy with that. I was 17 at the time. I really didn't know what I was doing, and no experience with recording. This is all new to me. When that record came out, there was a lot of proud people, a lot of proud people. They were shaking our hands and they were signing their, you know, their albums, and they were, you know, putting us on the radio. The word got out in the Philippines that some Filipino-American band was big. And in the Philippines, the wife of then President Marcos got word of that and wanted the band to go to the Philippines. I got my shots, I got everything, we were ready to go. And it says, oh no, it's too dangerous to go over there. There was martial law going on at that time. So, you know, we decided not to go. Yeah, and I think if we went, it would have changed history of the band.
Welcome to Epic Records Tagalog English Language Lesson number 1. First word, Daquila.
Daquila.
The language lesson. It was geared towards DJs that couldn't pronounce, you know, the words. That was the idea of the producers at that time, and I think it's kind of racist.
Some DJs have been playing Epic's new Filipino rock release, Daquila, without announcing the titles of the songs in order to avoid embarrassing phone calls and surprise visits from the small but wiry Filipino listeners.
It showed the ignorance of the people at the time.
Try using these words in your everyday conversations. And until then, mabuhay.
It was a 5-year contract. At that time, you were supposed to produce an album a year. And so, being that the band wasn't happy with Columbia or Epic, what was happening, or, you know, the progress of the band, you know, and so, you know, are we really going to just find another label? You know, and I think what I remember, they just, you know, gladly released us from the 5-year contract. We had some great 6 tunes on the second album, but that album was shelved. It was never released. The band at the time, we wanted to say something, you know, but it was a little too early, I think, in history. These guys aren't, you know, they're just too indigenous for us type of thing. It was kind of frustrating. You know, one band member left and another band member left and tried to hold it together. I went back to college. I was really young. That was the advice of my dad at the time. He said, if you want to enjoy playing music, get a job. And that's what he said, and I remember that. So the band members started, you know, leaving one at a time and trying to find other things. And me and my brother and my cousin, who was a drummer at the time, kept Tequila back as long as we can. And then, unfortunately, we started settling into start playing covers just so the band could still work. And then after a while, you just couldn't get gigs because DJs were taking over live bands, you know, at the time. The disco was happening, and then all the live venues were starting to disappear. So it was depressing altogether. The late 70s and through 80s, I was just away from the whole music scene. I was raising a family. We moved to the East Bay. But as far as what was happening with the album and Tequila, I was really not, it was ignorant as to what was going on. I started finding out all these things. I go, wow, you know, there's just a cult following that was happening. There's people following this band and this album, and then people are selling the album and collectibles and things like that. And I had no idea this was going on. The story and the legacy, you can't help. It's done. It's history. It's nothing I could do about that. But because it's important for me to tell the story of what happened and what we were trying to do at that time, I feel responsible for the people and also the past members of the band who were trying to do the same thing. And so now that they're not here anymore, I feel responsible for trying to let new generation hear the music, new generation know about this band. You know, so I'm having a good time recreating and sharing the music now because I think it's better, it's funkier, it's deeper. You're gonna feel what we're doing. Many people have thanked us for doing what we did. You know, it opened doors for a lot of people, but then we're talking about 45 years later, you know, we go back and it says they'll learn about this band. Well, these guys are badass. I says, oh my God, you know. So I'm hearing stuff like that. I always joke about saying Filipinos are everywhere. They are everywhere. And you just don't know it. They're in the film industry, they're in the news, they're in documentaries, they're writing books, they're chefs, they're in politics, they're everywhere. And you just don't know it. You know, and it's time to know that.
That was David Bustamante of the band Tequila. You can catch them performing this Sunday at the Undiscovered SF Creative Night Market. That's in San Francisco's SoMa District. That piece was produced by Bo Walsh. And if you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast, you can hear more from Bay Area Beats anytime, wherever you want. Today's Cross Currents team includes Taylor Caldwell, Janae Darden, Ariella Markowitz, Kristen McCandless, True Quinn, Michael Lockswingen, and Eli Wertschafter. Our engineers are James Rowlands, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shirin Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.